Tonight on Arena, Channel 4's new digital drama Beth, second seasons for both Fubar and the Buccaneers, as well as new albums from Van Morrison, Pioga and A. Smith, all of them up for review. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. And if you do that, you will see that sitting in front of me right now are Chris Wasser and Dee Malumbi. TV reviews as usual first tonight, as usual on a Friday night. Channel 4 unveils Beth, first original drama made for its new digital platform on YouTube, as well as going out on terrestrial TV. Is this a science fiction story? Kind of, I suppose, starring Nicholas Pinnock and Abby Lee as Joe and Molly, interracial couple longing for a child as they struggle with IVF and consider lots of other alternatives, adoption and straightforward conception if that would happen for them. Next up, Arnold Schwarzenegger said he'd be back, and he is, but this time in the second series of Fubar, where he and Monica Barbaro play father and daughter, both work as CIA operatives to the great surprise of each other. Matrix legend Carrie-Anne Moss joins the Netflix show this time round as the villain and as Arnie character's ex. And finally, The Buccaneers, also back for a second season. This is on Apple TV. Historical drama follows a group of fun-loving young American friends in 1870s London parading around in beautiful period frocks with a 21st century soundtrack playing in the background all the time. All of it based, well, not the 21st century soundtrack, the story based on an unfinished novel by Edith Wharton. Reviewers Chris Wasser and Dee Malumbi, as I say, with me in studio. I'm going to start with Beth. It's time to get a new sci-fi drama from Channel 4. I thought I was watching some kind of domestic drama when I started watching this, Chris, because it's a very timely domestic problem for lots of couples.
It is, yeah, and I think one that a lot of viewers will find quite relatable and quite devastating in places. So we have Joe and Molly, who are a couple, presumably in their 30s, let's say, living in London, have a very happy marriage, a very healthy relationship. But the thing that's missing from their life and the thing that they've been trying for so long is a baby.
Yeah.
And they've been through maybe 5 rounds of IVF and all of them have been unsuccessful.
Yeah.
So they go see a doctor one day.
Don't tell us anything about the doctor because I have a clip of him telling us what
he's right, yeah.
So it starts from there and
it
moves.
It starts from there and then in its second half moves into some very unusual sci-fi territory. And we do have to be quite careful, but
yeah, because you don't want to spoil lots of potential spoilers in what is 35 minutes.
Episodes. Yeah, but it's the delivery of this series that has been making headlines. So you've had even Thomas Pullen, who's the chief executive at Channel 4, describing the series as a truly groundbreaking project. It's on YouTube.
It's still a drama.
I think
just because it's on YouTube, that doesn't make it groundbreaking, does it?
I think what they've been going for. So this series was broken up into 3 episodes. One of them 15 minutes, the other 7 minutes, and the other like 14, something like that. And then later on was shown on terrestrial television. And I think what they're trying to do is bring in a younger audience. They're taking a contemporary angle where they're maybe looking at statistics to show that maybe attention spans are on the way out, that maybe younger viewers are consuming their content, in inverted commas, on TikTok and Instagram, you know, a few minutes at a time. So why can't we deliver television drama like that? It is a very depressing thought.
No, delivering a drama a few minutes at a time, perfectly acceptable.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all you have to watch, but we'll come back to what you have to do, even if you're delivering it a few minutes at a time. Let's have a listen to a clip from the first episode. And this, as you see, you're about to head into, they go into the doctor's office and they've had another round of IVF, which hasn't been successful. And the doctor, played here by Nick Blood, I love the fact that the doctor is played by a man called Nick Blood. He gives them some advice to Molly and Joe, Abby Lee and Nicholas Pinnock, playing Abby and Molly and Joe respectively.
Look, I know you have the resources, but the multiple rounds, the multiple miscarriages over the years, they take a toll. And that's the real cost, isn't it?
Yeah, we understand.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
Look, I'm obligated to give you some official information to guide you on the next stage of your journey, but I also have my own recommendation. Hear me out. Lots of sex. And I'm talking honeymoon. Lots. At this stage, couples need to stay in sync, reconnect. Molly, intercourse plays a huge part in rebalancing your hormones. And Joe, I'm sure you don't need any encouragement on that front.
That's Nick Blood, the only voice, in fact, that we heard, apart from a little snort, I think, from Molly, played by Abby Lee, and Nicholas Pinnock there in the Channel 4 drama, Beth. And Chris has already, Dee, made the case for this new format, as it were, putting it up on a different platform rather than on the telly in the corner of the room. The performers here and the story that's been told, certainly at the outset, I was totally gripped in their dilemma and what way things were going to go for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Nicholas Pinnock and Abby Lee do deserve a lot of credit. I think that they're absolutely excellent as the two leads. You see them share these scenes of like play and intimacy in the bedroom from kind of the offset. And you do really believe in that kind of chemistry. It does feel very genuine. What's interesting is that we do kind of follow Joe, the character, primarily, even so far as kind of going into his mind. For example, at one point, the couple kind of discuss fostering and adoption, and we see him kind of imagining different mixed race children who they might adopt, and he's kind of teaching them a bit of maths and drawing and stuff like that. And then later we kind of get an insight into his paranoid thoughts, because basically he kind of starts to suspect Molly might be having an affair with this doctor. So you see him actually imagining her in different parts of the house with him. So I thought that was quite interesting, and not only because we're relating more so to Joe, but also because it makes the character of Molly all that more enigmatic, and kind of where the kind of story goes, I suppose, is exactly what did happen to Molly and what did Molly do.
Yeah, so for chapter one, as they call it, in fact, is 12 minutes and 31 seconds long, according to my measurements. Chapter two then is 7 minutes and 35 seconds long, and again, nothing wrong with that length of time.
No.
Sometimes that is all you have.
Yeah.
You know, before you fall asleep, 12 minutes or 7 or whatever, you know, or you're on if you're on a commuting, you might say, well, I'll watch the next chapter on my way into work, you know, whatever. So that all makes sense to me. But you have to obey some of the rules of drama. You get into episode 2, things have moved on. There is a child there. Let's not go into how that has happened or anything like that. And Granny becomes involved. And again, very interesting character presented to us. And Granny said, oh, that's it. What's the dynamic here between the family?
Yeah, it's a very strange one. I can't really give too much away about the dynamic with the family. But Molly's mother does start to kind of worry, not about her daughter, actually, but about Joe's character. But getting back to that time, if you're going to have an episode or a chapter, as you say, that's 7 minutes, there's no room for error there. Everything needs to be airtight. You need to have a rock solid narrative. You need to not waste any word that the characters speak, and it all has to feel very complete. That's the problem for me with Beth. It's nothing to do with the length, it's nothing to do with the way that it was delivered to us, it's that it just feels incomplete. Now, I'm going to like maybe sidestep the whole sci-fi thing, because there is something that happens in the last few moments of this series that completely pulls the rug from under you.
Yeah.
And I know once you say sci-fi, and if you start arguing about it not making sense, I know some listeners say, well, it's sci-fi, it doesn't need to make sense. But there has to be some sort of internal logic here.
Yeah.
There has to be something that makes you think, okay, yeah, we were getting to that, or that makes sense even in this very
in this particular setup. And then episode 3, the really long one at 16 minutes and 3 seconds, they pushed the boat out there, Dee. And again, we can't go too much into that because we'll give too much away.
Yeah.
But when I got to the end of episode 3, I'll be quite honest, I thought, all right, that's okay. We know all the setup and all the dilemmas now. I wonder how this is going to resolve. And then, that is it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the resolution.
Yeah.
It's over.
Absolutely. And if I can return to the point of the whole idea of like no single minute needs to be wasted here. There's another character that pops up, Joe's brother, Jude. Mm. He's played by Alex Lanipuken. And there's this scene at a party where he's kind of teasing his brother, saying maybe he's the one that's the father. Yeah, and it is a bit uncomfortable. But again, it doesn't feel like it kind of fits in with kind of the rest of the story and what they've kind of been doing here. So I didn't think it quite worked, because then it kind of goes back to that whole idea of Joe being suspicious of Molly having an affair with the doctor, who we've only actually had one scene with. Which doesn't make any sense. When we do have that, I hate saying that there's a twist, but then maybe you kind of need to say that, because sometimes that's the only thing that's going to actually sell the story to someone. So there is this twist at the end of it, but it's just so strange. And I was left sitting there being like, am I meant to kind of be, you know, contemplating, you know, the profoundness around this? But really, I thought, what's the point at the end of this?
Exactly.
Which I think, if I'm reading both of you right, I certainly felt, I think you both felt, brilliant ideas here. Yes, let's try out the shorter form on different platforms. Of course, that's, you know, welcome to the world that doesn't stay in the same place for years on end. All great ideas, but somehow didn't... Great characters, some good writing, some brilliant scenes, but sadly didn't all add up. Stars from you, Dee?
Yeah, it was an interesting experiment. But yeah, thanks to that preposterous final twist, it just doesn't work. It's short enough that people might check it out just for the sake of curiosity, but it never quite worked. So 2.5 for me.
Okay. And I don't know why it's called Beth, by the way, either.
Maybe Beth, I missed it. Beth being the Hebrew word for a home, house or family unit. Oh, yeah, there's no character named Beth in here.
Yeah, I was waiting for Beth to appear all the time.
I think Uzo Ole, who's a photographer and a short filmmaker, they capture the film beautifully. I think it's so well performed.
Very stylish looking, yeah.
Yeah, there's some great ideas in there, but people will make comparisons to Black Mirror. I think they're unavoidable because there is that gotcha moment. It is a story that kind of has one eye on this anxious present and another on a terrifying future. But I think that gotcha moment, it just cheapens what is a very delicate, devastating story. If you're going to add a sci-fi element to that very human story, you need to be so careful and clever with it. And I don't think it is. So 2 stars.
Okay, 2 from you. That is Beth, available on Channel 4. It's available on the Channel 4 player and I guess on the Channel 4 YouTube channel as well. If you go in there and you'll get all 3 episodes. Adil Kiddison, 3 weeks time. Here are the next 3 episodes. Beth 2. Let's move on then to what is a second season, FUBAR, which is an acronym. And if I say that the end of it is up beyond all recognition, you can work out what the F is for yourself. Spies galore here with Arnold Schwarzenegger, Monica Barbaro and Carol Ann Moss. How much do we need to know about season one coming into this and be very careful about what we tell about families and what they're doing in season two?
I mean, like the first episode of season two pretty much kicks off like immediately after season one. So essentially, like setup wise, you've got everybody now living in a safe house because the identities of a number of characters were kind of left compromised at the end of season one. So it's kind of a madhouse because it's not only Luke, who is played by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and his daughter, Emma, who is played by Monica Barbaro. It's not only them and their family living there. It's also their team. And it's also, awkwardly enough, Emma and her mum's exes. So they are all living under the one roof, and it's kind of chaotic, as you can imagine, but comedy ensues, you know.
Comedy ensues. But I'm going to start by listening to it, which is kind of, I think this happens before we get the full credits, or certainly the credits have only rolled 30 seconds, and suddenly Schwarzenegger is driving through with being guided through all the streets as he dresses up as a fireman, latches onto the back of a fire truck, and he's down in the diamond area of Antwerp, most secure part of the world seemingly, but not for Arnie or the Luke character here. And then he finds himself sitting opposite a fella who you wouldn't want to be buying anything off, and certainly you wouldn't want to be messing around with him regarding diamonds, but Arnie's character isn't afraid of him.
You don't own a diamond concern. These are stolen. Why did you lie about who you are? Who are you really? Search him.
If Aston Foote is any hacker.
What the hell is that?
Cyanide. Case I get caught.
CIA?
Check outside!
Sie da draußen?
Alle leise. Gar nichts.
You came alone. What was the plan?
To get the coordinates. To kill all of you. And then to leave.
Why would you tell me?
And now, with all our guns out?
Here's to take the pill. And get it over with.
This will be fun.
It will be fun. I mean, you can hear that they're, you know, they are. It's kind of almost a pastiche of an espionage thriller in all of those type of scenes. And then there's the family scenes, which are slightly chaotic, to say the least. It is a bit of fun, this. I think that's probably the way to look at it, is it, Chris?
On paper, it sounds like a lot of fun. It's True Lies. the series. It's such a trivialized knockoff. And I think in the first season, they at least had some kind of signs around the place. They also had some cast members. I think Tom Arnold was in there at one stage, who was in Trivialized as well. Just to let you know that Arnie is aware that we've covered this sort of territory before, this spy not being truthful with their family about what they were working at, but with the added twist that their daughter is also a spy and she didn't tell dad. So I can't quite get away from this idea that while Trivialized was not a perfect film, but perfect as a 2-hour whatever it is film, this thing doesn't need to be stretched out over hours. And I do worry that Schwarzenegger, who is, I love Schwarzenegger, and he is as charismatic and as compelling and as magical as ever here. But I do worry that his jump to the small screen after 70 odd years is just this tactic to try and keep up with Sylvester Stallone, who's currently having
that old battle is back up.
I worry that secretly they're still competing with one another, that that Arnie was sitting around thinking, how come Sly has a hit on a streaming service, I might as well go find my own. So, but on paper, Fubar sounds like a lot of laughs, you know. And also this second season, the idea of spies living together in a safe house, having to participate in these group therapy sessions, you know, getting to the point where they completely, you know, put their lives at risk by going back out into the field, that sounds like a lot of fun. On the screen, my big problem with Fubar, aside from the fact that it's so derivative of True Lies, is that it's constantly explaining itself.
Yeah.
There's so, it might as well be called exposition, the series.
Yeah.
You know, there's one guy in the corner, Barry, whose entire job is to just sit there with a laptop and talk about the plot all the time. And that just annoyed me.
Yeah. Okay. Although there are lots of Easter eggs in here, little quotations all over the place. I mean, you can't resist anything that Arnold Schwarzenegger, you're going to say, I'll be back some point along.
Oh, yeah. And it's brought in twice in this season. And there actually is a point where the character of Greta, played by Carrie-Anne Moss, she's kind of trying to do this pole dancing move and she manages to mess it up. And he says, I've seen other women wipe out doing that move, which is a direct reference to True Lies. So obviously, like, you know, Arnie fans are going to love that stuff. They even manage to bring in the line Total Recall password.
Can't you have Total Recall on this? You
so
know?
Look, it's like, I found it a bit of fun. And for me, like, the issue with the series wasn't Arnold Schwarzenegger. I thought that he was doing kind of the very best that he could. But it is, like Chris said, it's just such a derivative series. It really feels like the script could have been AI generated. Like, it's so cliched. It's so silly. And in spite of its many, many, many attempts at humor, it's never particularly funny or charming. And even all the characters are so type-based, the action is uninspired. So I did find it quite disappointing, because I am a big Arnie fan, you know.
It's very hard not to be. Yeah, there's no stopping him. He's well into his 70s now and he's working away as if he's 42.
Yeah, he's actually meant to be 65 in this series, but he's 77 in real life.
There you go. He doesn't look that or act it, to be fair to him. Stars from you on this one?
Yeah, it's going to be 2 stars from me. I was also really, I just felt really sad for Carrie-Anne Moss in this show. I just thought that she deserves such worthier work than this. But like, look, it's I suppose it's for a certain audience out there. Someone must like it if it got a second season.
Yeah. You know? Okay. Well, the second season on Netflix.
Arnie liked it.
Yeah. Okay. And so 2 from D. Are you that down on it, Chris?
Probably, yeah. At least everyone get. There's a little bit of, you know, there are some proper characters in there, and some very likable actors, and they've all have something to work with, except for Carrie-Anne Moss, as Dee was saying, like, she's just playing a cartoon character. Okay. So look, Arnie hasn't lost his action man spark, but I think he can do better than this. So Stallone's winning this round, 2 stars.
All right, will he be back for season 3?
Probably.
If he foots the bill.
I'd say he's getting a few bob into his own pocket somehow or other. Let us move on then to The Buccaneers, another returning series. It's on Apple TV. This is it's based on an unfinished Edith Wharton novel, and it's a classic Edith Wharton, Henry James type of thing. American women, or American woman, in this case, a group of American women come to England, 19th century England, and kind of try to fit in a society where they don't fit in.
Yep, that's it. One based on an unfinished novel from that was published then posthumously in 1938. I think it was finished at one stage by a different writer, and it's been adapted for television before, because there was all sorts of complaints the last time around that this is basically just kind of, you know, cashing in on the Bridgerton success, because there are an awful lot of similarities similarities between the way Bridgerton is presented and the Buccaneers is presented. You know, as you mentioned at the top, that whole 21st century pop soundtrack. Yeah. But story-wise, we have five American women in the first season, and you probably do need to have seen the first season to kind of, you know, jump in the second.
Because, yeah, I mean, it brings you straight in.
Oh, it's straight, yeah. Like, the first season ended with a wedding, and the second one opens with the wedding just finishing.
Yeah.
So you have these five American women who, inspired by one of their friends who is already marrying an English chap from high society London, they all go to London to join the marriage market, and they're all looking for husbands, they're looking for potentially trouble, they're looking for a lot of fun in a place where they're not supposed to be having, or not supposed to be allowed to have any. So, and we got to know characters like Nan and Jeannie. I think the first season ends with Nan's wedding so basically there's a love triangle. So Nan is one of the characters that's come over from America. She is in love with this guy named Guy, but she can't actually be with him. She has to marry a duke named Theo for all sorts of reasons to protect her sister. And at the beginning of the second season, we see her getting married to Theo.
Is this the most beautiful set of people that could ever be found and put on the screen? I mean, right across the board, these are beautiful people.
Yes, and I loved every minute of it. I'm so, so happy that we are covering this this week, because I adored season one of, I almost called it Bridgerton there, the Buccaneers. I love Bridgerton too. Yeah, look, I have to admit, like, and me and my girlfriends are all the same, there is something about costume dramas, just seeing all the gorgeous outfits, the glamorous period settings, the romance and the drama. Does it get a bit silly at times? Is it a bit too, like, reliant on characters not giving each other basic bits of information?
Yeah.
Yes, and probably too much drama is derived from that. But at that, I absolutely, like, fell in love with all of these characters. I just wanted the best for all of them. I love seeing, like, the girls' friendship with one another. I love seeing all the, like, love and different relationships bloom. And one thing I really, really appreciate about the Buccaneers, as distinct from other kind of period dramas, is so there are so many examples of this genre where the whole idea of marriage is that it provides the happy ending. But in the Buccaneers, it's not the resolution. Yeah. In fact, it's often the beginning of many problems for these young women, as would have been the case, you know,
in that era. Well, the Christine Frusseth character, Nan, who's essentially the central character, certainly in the early parts of season two, and she's now this duchess, so her mother-in-law is the dowager of Tintagel, is that how we say the place that they are Dutch and dowager of, respectively. And the mother-in-law here is played by Amelia Bullmore, and every marriage has a price.
The wedding party needs a bride. Your guests are asking for you.
Theo thinks this is real. He thinks I chose to marry him.
Which you did.
Oh, I chose to save my sister. What have we done? He deserves to know.
All Theo needs to know is that he has a dutiful and loving wife.
You don't care. But we're lying to your son. No, I need to tell him.
We had an agreement. I will get Jenny away. I will keep her safe. I will also neglect to tell Theodore who I found in your room last night. In return, you have two jobs. Never to breathe a word to Theo of my involvement, and to make him happy. Annabelle, what must come next is obedience.
I decide what comes next.
I don't think you do, Nan. Well, maybe she does, actually, as the season goes on. I would guess that she does take a little bit of control. That was, who were the two characters that we saw there? Both Nan, played by Christine Frosseth, and the Dowager Duchess of Tintagel, the mother-in-law, played by Amelia Bullmore. One of the things about Bridgerton was it kind of laughed at itself. It had a great sense of humour. There was that within it. I mean, there's a lot of drama in this, and, you know, it's fairly soft sell. You have a situation where you have a mother who, and her sister, is the sister actually the mother of one of the main characters or the aunt of one of the main characters? We're trying to find that out in that scene. I'm sure that'll be dragged on for lots of the season. Does it take itself maybe a little bit too seriously?
I thought so, yeah. And I've never been Bridgerton's biggest fan, but at least it does have that sense of humour. It also had a star in Nicola Coughlan. I'm not seeing anyone of that particular calibre here. I think with a wittier script, with a tighter script and a stronger cast, it could have been something special, because, you know, historical romances will never go out of fashion. And I think, you know, frothy, frivolous television shows like this about, you know, these handsome lords and these rebellious heroines, like, they will, and on, you know, and the romantic entanglements they get themselves involved in, they will always be entertaining to watch, so long as there's a spark of energy there, so long as there's, like, some sort of attempt being made to try and add something fresh to that genre. But I don't think the Buccaneers does that. What it seems to be doing is it approaches the narrative it approaches in terms of its style, it kind of reminded me at times of like a Perfume ad. That's about as deep as it goes. It's all style and very little substance. And the women, but the female performers, I don't really have much complaints about the actual Buccaneers of the tale, but the guys, Guy Remmers, Matthew Broome, they've clearly been hired for something other than their acting abilities, because they're quite vacant here. And I found their performance just baffling at times.
Yeah, well, don't they look at one of them at one point and say, look at that jaw?
They really do, yeah. And it's,
but maybe maybe that's the point they're making. Maybe the gaze has been turned the other way around. Stars from you on this one, Chris?
I just think armed with a huge Apple budget, it obviously is an amazing looking series, but a huge Apple budget won't fix a dreary teleplay, it won't fix lifeless performances, and I think there's a few too many of those in here. So great ideas, but the execution is all off. 2 stars.
And what are you saying, Dee? I think you're happier.
I'm much happier. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. Like, this is exactly my cup of tea. And I know a lot of other female listeners out there will absolutely adore this series. Look, it is a bit like soapy, so you have to be prepared for that going into it. But it is absolutely gorgeous. And there's a lot to love in there in terms of like those female characters.
And Christine Hendricks, who plays the mother character. Yeah, you know, and she's not the only one. I mean, even the younger players are really giving it socks here. Mm-hmm. So 3.5 from you on that one, Dee. So that's Dee Malumbi and Chris Wasser talking to us about, first of all, Beth. All 3 episodes of Beth are available now to stream on the Channel 4 player or on its YouTube channel, which is called 4 The Drama. Oh, look what they did there. All episodes of FUBAR Season 2 streaming now on Netflix. Buccaneers, The Buccaneers Season 2 is on Apple TV. First episode dropped on Wednesday this week, and subsequent episodes are being released every Wednesday, just like it used to happen in the olden days on terrestrial TV. All right, into our album reviews then on Friday evening. Van Morrison returns with Remembering Now, first album of original material since 2022, and he certainly seems in a much better place than he was back then. He's moved on from songs about mind control and the World Economic Forum. After a 4-year hiatus, Bjoga return as well with Phases, boundary-pushing album, Irish rock and Irish folk and pop, EDM, and even a bit of surf rock in there, you could argue. Whether they're giving Dave Grohl a Baron lesson or collaborating with Ed Sheeran on Galway Girl, well known for bringing Irish trad to the masses. That's what Bjoga do. And singer-songwriter A. Smith follows up his acclaimed debut, which you told me what it was called, Louise and Danny?
Last Animal,
thank you very much. Can't read my own writing. Last Animal was the name of the acclaimed debut, and he's back now with Hello Goliath, deeply personal record shaped by fatherhood, reflection and a desire to find beauty in life's quieter moments. There, Louise Bruton and Danny Kilmartin both known the name of that debut and sharing it with us this evening. Let's start with Van the Man, Van Morrison, and why don't we just start with a bit of music? First track on the album, Down to Joy. Down to Joy, title of the opening track on Van Morrison's new album, Remembering Now. And Louise Bruton and Danny Kilmartin, as I say, in studio with me for our album reviews on this Friday evening. Louise, when I started that track playing, I thought, that, I could have heard that track years ago, but I'm nothing wrong with that necessarily. There was the organ, there was the familiar guitar sound, there was the horns in the background, you know, and then in comes Van Morrison's voice sounding just as lively and that wonderful kind of ease of delivery that he has had for years and years.
And that is one of the two very surprising things about this album, because he's 79 years old and this is his 47th album. So, and it doesn't, you could compare this to albums released in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and his voice has not faltered, which is just biologically, it's I don't know,
amazing.
It's a marvel. And he is, that title of the album, Remembering Now, is he's certainly remembering now. And that song, Down to Joy, was originally written for Kenneth Branagh's album, or film.
Belfast,
yeah. So, which is where Van Morrison is from. So he's really going back and just tracing his roots. And it's a very interesting thing because his last few albums have not been so connective.
Yeah,
like you said, it's, you know, about government mind control and a lot of cover albums. So this, in a way, is a real kind of return to form. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are just breathing a sigh of relief that it's returned to form. In content and also just in that nostalgic comfort sound that he delivers.
And there's nothing wrong with just giving the sound that you want to hear from an artist that you've loved for whatever number of years, 40 years easily, if not more, 50 years probably at this stage.
No, absolutely not. I mean, look, while there's very few surprises sonically, we've grown to know what Van Morrison does and what he is.
And can do.
And I think that, if nothing else, I think there's something admirable about his refusal to slow down. Like, he is one of the most prolific songwriters we've ever produced. And it's great to hear him in good form again, I think, you know.
Let's have a listen to the title track, which it's a slightly different kind of texture to it from the opening track on the album and from some of the other tracks as well. But again, a very familiar Van Morrison sound, remembering now. Presence in the landscape, past and always present, remembering now. All around your body or its feet. Remembering now, the title track from Van Morrison's new album, his 47th, am I right with that number, Louise Bruton? And I was saying it earlier on when we were talking about that vocal delivery. He never forces his voice. He never pushes that voice to kind of belt it out at you or to go up too high or down too low. He's almost speaking to you. It's such a matter of fact type of delivery.
I mean, if you had a tone like that,
Why would you?
It's such a rich kind of mahogany voice.
If it ain't broke.
And again, because he is like that song, he's just kind of going back these memories. It is like he is talking directly to you, because there's the other song, Stomping Ground, which is where he's just going, take me back to Strandtown, take me back to Church of Ireland, take me back to all of these venues and street corners and places that probably no longer exist in the way that he remembers. So it's a meandering kind of exploration of his brain and his memory. But nothing
smolchy about those type of rememberings or nostalgias, way he delivers it.
He does have sort of he has an interesting relationship with his past as well. He left the North when he was like 17 and moved to the UK and then the US, and he kept a distance from a lot of the troubles in the North and didn't really comment on it. He was raised Protestant. And even in this song where he says, take me back to the Church of Ireland, there's this thing where, I don't know, when you move on in life and you can step back, maybe he's getting more, having a bigger love for the place he grew up in.
Yeah. Stars from you on this one. If Van Morrison doesn't need stars from any of us, but anyway,
he doesn't need anything for us. But it's a 4 stars just for pure nostalgia and the surprise of, you know, sticking true to his guns.
I should say it is a 16-track album, and sometimes I felt, well, would we have managed with 13 or 14 or even 12 tracks?
Yeah, I think that would have been the only knock I would have had myself. Now, really, I mean, 14 tracks at an hour and 8 minutes or thereabouts.
It's 16, it's 14.
It's 14 or 16. It's a long one anyway. Solid but unsurprising. Kind of, I think it's more comfort food for fans, more so than anything that's going to usher in new fans. So 3 out of 5 for me.
Solid 3 out of 5 for Remembering Now from Van Morrison. Let's move on to album number 2, A. Smith. Is the title of the artist here, or that's what he calls himself. We mentioned his album, which is his debut album, which I still can't remember the name of. I'll let you tell me this time, Danny. What was it called again?
I've forgotten already. That's our
guys, Last Animals.
Last Animals. Yeah. We'll all be asking the name of it before
Friday,
the end of the programme.
There
we go.
Last Animals was the hugely successful debut album for him, and now he's back with Hello Goliath. A lot of emotional tension, I think, in here. A lot of themes that he's exploring, Danny. Where is he heading with this?
I think you'd mentioned that the album Last Animals was a bit of a success for him, and it seemed like it was something that overwhelmed him, the prospect of writing a follow-up. So he chose the name Hello Goliath as a kind of a reference to the fact that he's taken a step back. He is feeling overwhelmed and he's looking at the giant in front of him, this insurmountable task. But I think what kind of brought him back and able to move forward was that he'd become a father, and it was singing to his son that reminded him of how simple music could be. So that kind of gave him the strength to go on and write this album.
Let's listen to it is the opening track, Can't Stop the Rain.
Yeah,
Can't Stop the Rain, the title of that song from Hello Goliath, new album from A. Smith. Aaron Smith is the guy's name, but he goes by A. Smith. What kind of influences are you hearing in there? That song is kind of maybe not so much, but certainly in others I heard a lot of kind of country and folk country type of stars of yore coming across.
Yeah, I mean, in the build-up to the creation of the album itself, he did kind of name-check the likes of Glenn Campbell, yeah, Paul McCartney, Joni Mitchell, and kind of a shoegaze band, Mercury Rev, as influences. You could argue that in part he sounds a bit Neil Youngish as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I must say, in the middle of it, it's particularly down around about track five or six of ten, I thought, that's very Neil Young.
Yeah. It's the kind of the reserve delivery in the vocal. There's something kind of fragile there, but it's everyman music, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and also musically, in terms of the production and what's going on in the background, it's a very simple vocal delivery, very straightforward vocal delivery, but there's quite a complex set of textures at times in the music behind it, Louise.
Yeah, so when in a former life, when A. Smith was a member of Van Music, they were an electropop band, and now he's switched out to the digital for all analog. So it's a very lustrous record with, you know, it seems like everything was recorded at once in the studio. And it helps him explore these themes without giving away too much personally, which I think is a very strong asset to have as an artist, not to put out everything going on in your life personally. There's one song, Houston, which I think is just amazing, which seems to be about the dynamic between him and his mother. And he goes back to when he was a child sitting in with his mum and then watching kind of Apollo 13 happening, and that he relates the story of that to his own personal life. But we don't learn what that is. Mm. And the restraint, but just giving us enough of a thread, I think, is a very powerful storytelling tool.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of Houston. Yes, of course he was going to say, Houston, we've got a problem. That is the track Houston from A. Smith, Aaron Smith's new album, Hello Goliath. Overall, and stars from you on this one, Danny?
I give it a 4. It's a real triumph of less is more.
Less is more. And what are you saying, Louise?
Yep, 4 stars. And I must recommend the song Bees, or Please Don't Send Our Bees to War. It is a total joy.
Even the title tells you where the guy is at. Please Don't Send Our Bees to War. Right, we've another album, maybe 2, to talk about after these. Danny Kilmartin and Louise Bruton still with me. We're moving on to album number 3 now. Phases comes from Bioga, and it opens with a track called Anne Bonny. And Bonny, the title of the opening track from Bioga's, it's their second album, isn't it? Or no, it's not. They're more than 2 albums. They're well into double figures at this stage, I think. Phases is the title of the album. When you think about what's happening in traditional music, in traditional Irish music at the moment, and the Lancomes of this world, etc., that are out there, what are Bioga doing that's different from that, or the same as all of that, Louise?
They are most definitely on the other side of the dial to what Lancome and like Lisa O'Neill are doing with their music. I feel like the likes of Lancome and Lisa and so on are finding music from all of the centuries and finding ways to give it a place in the now. So they're finding the politics, they're finding the kind of social connections and the social kind of frictions. Whereas I feel that Bioga, they live in the very safe terrain of what trad music is. They lean into maybe what the perceptions of Irish music and Irish culture is. And I think a story that really kind of lends it to that is where they were teaching Dave Grohl how to play the Baron. They were teaching him how to play in Ed Sheeran's fake Irish pub activation installation At the Coachella Festival. Mm. So it just seems to be a type of thing that maybe people who yearn for a type of Ireland that doesn't exist or yearn for the myth of Ireland or Irish music.
But they are bringing in, I mean, obviously the vocals are, then the production on the track that we heard, a bit of Anne Bonny, very clear. Everything is, you know, you're not, there's nothing fussy about what they're doing. And they bring in little elements of Celtic rock and a kind of gentle type of electronic, might be going too far, but certainly little elements of contemporary music in there too.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear the kind of, on later tracks on the album, say for example Tradfather, there's these kind of synthy whooshes and 808 beats and that kind of thing, but at the same time it just seems very sanitized or something, whereas you listen to the likes of a Lancome or a Mary Wallopers or John Francis Flynn, and while John Francis Flynn, for example, uses electronic elements in his own output, he somehow manages to imbue what he's doing with Irish music with
people
the
might
psyche,
argue though, yeah, you know? People might argue that it's a much more challenging listen than the likes of Bjork,
and they'd be right to say so. And I think that I'm not saying there's not a place for a sound like Bjork. It's just it seems a little bit too. The focus is more on the precision of the playing and the clarity of the production than it is on the actual soul of the music.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to the track you mentioned there, a little bit of Tradfather. Tradfather from Bjoga there. I suppose you have to recognise they need to sell albums as well, and there's no harm in that.
There's no harm in that at all. No, there is definitely an audience for this, but it does feel that in the landscape now at the moment of such kind of powerful folk and trad music in Ireland, this doesn't seem to be pushing the boat out that far. Mm. But like that being said, the song Fire Water goes into darker territories, and Niamh Dunn, the vocalist in the band, her voice, when she's showing some restraint and not going into the kind of more twee side of things, it does go to kind of a nicer kind of sound.
All right. Yeah. Stars for you from you for Bjoga, Louise?
2.5.
2.5 overall. And stars from you, Danny?
It's a 2 from me.
A 2 from Danny for Phases from Bjoga. We were also talking about Hello Goliath from A. Smith and Remembering Now from Van Morrison. Little bit of addition to our music news tonight. Neil Young released Talking to Trees, recorded with his touring band, the Chrome Hearts. He takes a few pops at Elon Musk with certain lines. If you're a fascist, then get a Tesla. Is the opening line of one of the songs. Talking to the Trees is out today. Let's have a listen to a track, a little bit of a track from it called Family Life.
Building dreams with his new girl, living a life that's meant to be.
That's Family Life, a little taste of one of the tracks from Neil Young's new album, which is called, The Trees. Talking to the Trees. Louise, I know we're not reviewing it per se, but you have had at least one listen to it. What are you hearing from even listen number one?
I think he's, when so many of his peers are shying away from saying what they really believe, he doesn't. And it's just so refreshing that he's kind of coming out. A lot of the rest of the songs on the album, there's a bit more of a kick and a bit more of a punch to them. And he's a man who just doesn't give a damn. And it's wonderful.
Even in the looseness of the musical delivery there, it's kind of like, here are the three chords, go for it.
He's having a lot of fun. Is it the Chromes, the band he has with him?
Yeah, the Chrome Hearts.
Chrome Hearts, and it's just, he's got musicians who he knows share kind of a kindred spirit with him, and they're all just having a great time.
You haven't had a chance yet, Danny, but you're looking forward to it.
Oh, very much so. I mean, look, the man can do no wrong in my eyes. Some people with age become more cantankerous, but they do so in the wrong ways, and he is not one of those people.
In all the right ways. Okay.
Exactly.
Well, I'm sure that people might check that out as well. Talking to the Trees alongside Van Morrison's Remembering Now, Hello Goliath from A. Smith, and Bjoga with Phases. What am I looking for? Yes, I wanted to tell you what was happening on Monday's programme. Kevin Barry's new play, The Cave, starring Tommy Tiernan, Erin Monaghan, Judith Ruddy, opens at the Abbey Theatre tonight. In fact, we'll be reviewing it on Monday. Writer Sheena Lambert tells us about the film Botcha. This is a murder mystery set on All-Ireland weekend. It's based on Sheena's novel, The Lake. And the Waterford band, The Ran, will be talking about their upcoming show at Tunefest, which is a new traditional Irish music festival in and around that part of the world.
think it's down near Waterford. That's on Monday night's Arena, but that's our lot for this evening and for this week. Paula Shields researched, Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Harry Bookless was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sian O'Gorman. Back with you Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.